Hello, and welcome to Centerfold. I'm Robert O'Brien. This week, we're going to start with the 20 questions section from the Winter 2020 issue of Playboy, featuring Diane Guerrero. What makes a superhero? A voice, a cause, and a will to change the world. The actress-activist who headlines the HBO Max premiere of DC's Doom Patrol has all three and isn't backing down. By Samantha Helu Hernandez. Question 1. Orange is the New Black gave you your most notable role to date. Maritza Ramos, one of Litchfield Penitentiary's original inmates. On the show's final season, which debuted on Netflix in July, Ramos is deported to Colombia, mirroring what happened to your parents nearly two decades ago when you were 14 years old. How did you prepare for those scenes? Guerrero. I didn't have to look far to understand what it would be like for my character to be in jail once again to be taken away. I know what that's like. My mom was taken in handcuffs to the airport and loaded up on a plane. It's something I've lived with my entire life. It's desperate. It's lonely. So I tried to go back to that time. Honestly, because of the work I'm doing today, I'm back there all the time. It was cathartic. Question 2. So it wasn't re-traumatizing? Guerrero. No. What's re-traumatizing is knowing that some fucking guy went to Walmart and shot up people because he thought there was an invasion of Mexicans because of what our president has said. That's re-traumatizing. That instills fear in me that my life can be taken away at any time. Portraying it artistically, or even retelling my story, as hard as that is at times, is a means to an end. It's not re-traumatizing. Question 3. You revealed your parents' deportation in a 2014 op-ed piece in the Los Angeles Times. In 2016, you released a memoir, In the Country We Love, about growing up in the U.S. without them. What motivated you to share your story and become an activist for immigration reform? Guerrero. My career was moving very fast, but I felt I wasn't being honest. I felt deceitful, not speaking about something that was very real to me. The issue of immigration was being tossed around inaccurately, and Trump was using the immigrant community as a scapegoat. What do you do when your community is flat-out labeled as rapists and murderers, and people run with that narrative? I couldn't offer a general response as a person of color, as a brown woman. I had to be like, yo. As a child of a separated family, as a child coming from a marginalized community that often experiences incarceration, I'm speaking to you as a child who lived all this. I want people to look at me, see me, and know what the fuck I'm about. Question 4. How'd you find a space to inhabit in this country? Guerrero. If your circumstances bring you to a place where someone has to be charitable to you, you develop a habit of wanting to be invincible out of needing to appease folks. I got to the point of wanting to kill myself. That's how invincible I wanted to get. I had to see a therapist who told me that it was okay to want things and to have dreams. I had to change the way I was programmed by reciting affirmations that I was worthy. That's how I began, little by little, to take up space again. But it's a work in progress. I work every day to not shrink myself, to allow myself to speak freely in places I'm scared to speak. Question 5. In August, you told Vanity Fair that you feared becoming a, quote, poster child of deportation, end quote. Do you feel that you have? Guerrero. No, I don't. I thought that people were trying to pigeonhole me. In reality, only you can pigeonhole yourself. Only you can allow people to put you in a box. I am who I am. I care about what I care about. I'm strong in my convictions. I dictate my future. I dictate my outcome. Deportation, what happened to my family, is a sliver of who I am and what has happened to me. I have much more to say, much more to contribute. Question 6. In 2015, you were named the Obama administration's inaugural class of presidential ambassadors for citizenship and naturalization, which aimed to promote naturalization among some 8 million qualified people. But some immigration groups have called Barack Obama the deporter-in-chief. How is what's happening now under President Donald Trump different from what happened under the previous administration? Guerrero. The rhetoric isn't the same. Look, the Obama administration deported a lot of families, but Obama also tried to implement immigration reform, and he was shut down. He didn't have the Senate and the House. He tried to enact an executive order, and it was blocked by the courts. He was on his own. I understand that. I'm not at all saying that separating families is okay. He just didn't have the support. Question 7. Your advocacy includes volunteering with the Immigrant Legal Resource Center and sitting on the board of directors of Mi Familia Vota, an organization that promotes civic engagement. What does common sense immigration reform look like to you? Guerrero. We update the visa system. Have we tried to set up a path to citizenship for people who are here, who have been here for years, and who have supported the economy? No. Reform involves repealing laws that are hurting people. It means coming up with ways to keep our borders secure, but which also create a new way forward. It does not mean deporting 11 million people and collapsing our economy. Immigration and customs enforcement is a relatively new thing. We don't need ICE. We don't need another agency going after families, putting them in jail solely to have higher body counts in these centers. We don't need to be putting money into this agency. Immigration is not a crime. A lot of immigrant families are taken advantage of because we don't know our rights. I joined the Immigrant Legal Resource Center because it focuses on education. As soon as I educated myself, I felt more powerful. I give information to folks and direct them in a healthier way. Compare that to my parents, who hired the first bozo who offered to help them with their visas. The immigration system is convoluted and made for people to misunderstand. I just try to be a portal for information and get it out there to the folks who need it. Question 8. Speaking of ICE, in August, on the first day of school, authorities arrested 680 people suspected of working in the country illegally across 7 Mississippi food processing plants. Videos of children crying made the rounds online and sparked debates about coverage of this issue. Some argue that it's important for the public to see this kind of imagery. Others deem it exploitative and a form of trauma porn. What's your take? Guerrero. People need to see it. Honestly, it was the first time I saw an image of what I felt like the day I came home and my folks weren't there. I don't know if I felt validated, because it's difficult saying that. I know these kids are suffering, but I felt like that's what I've been trying to tell people. That's what it feels like. It's your first day of school. You love your parents. You wish they were there with you. We need to continue sharing images like those. I go through a lot not having my parents here. They're getting older. I'm getting older. I'm missing a lot of their milestones, and they're missing mine. That stunts your growth in a way. People need each other. They need their families. That's what the fucking American dream is all about. Question 9. Do you still believe in the American dream? Guerrero. Of course, there are so many great things about this country and so many opportunities to be had. Equality for all and justice for all. That's the American dream I want to live, where everyone is treated fairly, where families are able to stay together, where this country provides what it promises for all families, not just white families and the families at the top. That's what I'm working toward. I mean, what else am I going to do? Question 10. Is it possible for your parents to come back to the U.S. legally? Guerrero, I would love for them to. This is where it all began. This is where our life started and where I would like to finish it here with them. Question 11. You play Crazy Jane on DC's TV series Doom Patrol, whose second season premieres on HBO Max this spring. Crazy Jane experiences childhood trauma and develops superpowers as a result. What superpowers have you developed? Guerrero, becoming someone else. Here's an example. In college, I told someone that my parents were business owners, that they were in Columbia on a business venture, and I was just here studying political science because I was interested in social justice and wanted to become a lawyer. The real reason I wanted to become a lawyer was so I could bring my parents back. In terms of relating to Jane, when she allows herself to work with others and surrender to community, she finds light in that. It's similar to when I surrender to my feelings and working with others in my community. Question 12. Have you ever felt tokenized in your career? Guerrero. Yeah, in auditions for Drug Dealer Girlfriend Number 1 and Maid Number 2. That still happens. That's why being on Doom Patrol and getting the role of Crazy Jane have meant so much to me. To have a Latinx land a person normally reserved for a white person? Latinxes aren't allowed to be superheroes. It's the strangest thing that we can't be seen in fantasy situations. Only white people can be in fantasies? Only white people can be superheroes? That's fucking preposterous. Question 13. Crazy Jane also has dissociative identity disorder. There aren't many pop culture representations of mental health issues in Latinx communities. You've struggled with depression, right? Guerrero. Hey, we have mental health issues. This happens in our community. This needs to be looked at. If that goes overlooked, that person is going to spend a long time trying to figure it out. Who knows where they may or may not end up? What if my parents had seen a show or a movie where they talked about that? We are so informed by what we watch and what's out there and available to us. That's why we have to fight to be in these spaces. Question 14. Describe a moment when you realize what it means to be Latinx in Hollywood. Guerrero. I mean, just go out there and try to get a job. Get a job and then try to get paid as much as your counterparts. That's when you realize you're not on the same playing field. Or you think you have an opportunity to work with a producer who says they're interested in your story, or interested in telling more immigration stories, or stories that impact the Latinx community, and then you get an email from this person that starts with, "Hey, babe." That's when you realize, oh, I'm a woman. I'm a brown woman. This is still going on, and that's still something I have to fight. Question 15. Singing, not acting, was your introduction to performing. What does music signify to you? Guerrero. It's how I stay alive, man. I love singing. I haven't done it in a professional setting yet, but it's coming. Music has saved me. It's the way I connect to my ancestry, to my family. Every Sunday, my family used to put on music, clear out the furniture, and dance in the living room. What those songs were saying meant something. Question 16. Like many Latinx people born in the 1980s, you listened to a lot of Selena growing up. What does she represent to you? Guerrero. She represented the new Latin American, right? A person who was connected to her culture and could express herself so deeply but could also be very American. A mashup of two beautiful things. It's what I've always considered myself, a mashup of everything wonderful. I could speak Spanish. I could enjoy all these beauties my culture offered, like music, dance, food, and language. But I could also enjoy American music, American food, and American customs. I could fucking bring all these together and just be a superhero. Question 17. What's your favorite Selena song? Guerrero. No Me Queda Más, of course. The most intense, just mad emo song. Question 18. You said that growing up you tried to be the good girl to the point of harming yourself if you thought you were sinning. You are now perceived to be a sex symbol. When did you embrace your sexuality? Guerrero. It wasn't until very recently. I've always been sexual, but it was something I tried to hide because I was afraid of falling into the stereotype of the sexualized Latino who thought she'd get anywhere with her sexuality or fuck her way out of any situation. I've been able to fuck myself out of a couple situations, but that is not my go-to. My go-to is my brain and my heart and what I've learned from my family and community. That is how I've gotten ahead. Question 19. Do you feel your activism has ever been discounted because of your sex appeal? Guerrero. Latinas especially are not allowed to be sexual and smart at the same time. It wasn't until after I wrote my book that I allowed myself to feel sexy and say, fuck it. I don't care what you say about my breasts. I don't care what you say about how I look. Being comfortable with my sexuality is a part of me and in the message I want to give to people about loving themselves. It all goes into how I felt about my brown skin growing up, feeling that it was ugly or less than. A wide nose, your indigenous nose, is ugly. Your brown eyes aren't as interesting as blue ones. Shut off the noise that tells you you're not as good enough or white enough that you're sexy is bad, that you're sexy is crass in some way. Question 20. When do you feel most alive? Guerrero. When I'm singing or dancing. When I'm experiencing music through my veins. When I'm eating my mother's food. When those beans hit my mouth and just, I know what that is. It's life, you know. A life force for the heart. Continuing from the winter 2020 issue of Playboy. In drugs we trust. What would happen if the United States decriminalized drug possession? A veteran drug policy expert offers some trippy outcomes. By Jag Davies. The drug policies in this country are preposterous. As long as people who use drugs are treated like criminals, mass criminalization and mass overdose deaths will remain two of the greatest ongoing tragedies in the United States. Accidental drug overdoses are the leading cause of death for Americans under the age of 50, exceeding fatalities from gun violence, car accidents, homicide, and HIV/AIDS. According to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention's National Center for Health Statistics, more than 68,000 deadly drug overdoses occurred in the United States in 2018 alone. At the same time, U.S. law enforcement makes an arrest for drug possession every 25 seconds, adding up to well over 1 million arrests a year. It's the single most common reason for arrest in the country. These arrests do nothing to reduce the use of drugs. In fact, criminalization amplifies safety risks by pushing people who use drugs away from public health services. What if I told you that decriminalization of all drugs, yes, all drugs, could put an end to that? Under decriminalization, people who are caught using or possessing a small amount of drugs or found with drug paraphernalia would no longer face criminal penalties, meaning any form of criminal punishment, including arrest, jail, and imprisonment, would be abolished. This idea, to cease to treat drug possession as an unlawful offense, isn't as outlandish as it might seem. According to a poll conducted by the Cato Institute, 55% of Americans support decriminalization. Leading governmental, medical, public health, and civil rights groups, including the American Civil Liberties Union and the Global Commission on Drug Policy, plus celebrity activists such as Richard Branson, have also supported decriminalization, arguing that drug policy reformation would revolutionize how the U.S. handles use and addiction. Decriminalization has proven to be transformative in other nations across the world. Numerous countries, including the Czech Republic, the Netherlands, Spain, and most notably Portugal, have had remarkable success with it. The Portuguese regime, established by Antonio Salazar in 1932, closed the country off from the rest of the world for 40 years. When the suppressive rule abruptly ended in 1974, in came the drugs the country had barely experienced before. By the 1990s, 1 in 100 people in Portugal was addicted to heroin, and the country's rate of HIV infection had hit the highest in the European Union. But since 2001, when Portugal became the first country to decriminalize all drugs, the number of people voluntarily entering treatment has increased significantly as rates of addiction and adolescent drug use have fallen. From 2000 to 2015, HIV infections in Portugal plummeted from 104.2 new cases per million to 4.2 cases per million. Given decriminalization's successful track record, senior levels of government are attempting to pave the way for it in an array of countries, including Canada, Ghana, Ireland, Malaysia, Mexico, Norway, and Scotland. Still, only a handful of U.S. policymakers embrace the idea. Some progress has been made in reforming the war on drugs in the United States, mostly by cities and states, not by the federal government. Alaska, California, Colorado, Connecticut, Oklahoma, Oregon, and Utah have reduced drug possession from a felony to a misdemeanor. Dozens of cities around the country have instituted pre-arrest diversion programs such as law enforcement-assisted diversion. 911 Good Samaritan laws, some of which limit criminalization at the scene of an overdose for witnesses who call for emergency medical assistance, have been adopted in all 50 states. Progress is also made toward cannabis legalization in all 50 states, giving hope that once unthinkable drug reforms can happen with positive results. Since Colorado, Washington, Alaska, Oregon, Washington, D.C., California, Massachusetts, Maine, Nevada, Michigan, Illinois, and Vermont approved measures to legalize cannabis, states have saved millions and are allocating the dollars earned from cannabis taxes to civil sectors. Colorado, for instance, $225 million in tax revenue was distributed to the Colorado Department of Education from 2015 to 2018. A study published in the journal Economic Inquiry shows compelling evidence that opioid overdose deaths in states that have legalized recreational cannabis dropped by 20 to 35%. The national debate around cannabis has evolved from whether the remaining states should legalize it to how they should legalize it. But even though a 2018 Rasmussen Report survey found that only 9% of likely U.S. voters deemed the war on drugs a success, and despite positive case studies ranging from Portugal's decriminalization to cannabis legalization stateside, the Trump administration is making moves to ramp up the drug war. This marks a shift away from modest Obama-era reforms that slowed the growth of mass incarceration. Trump and his ilk have weaponized the overdose crisis in an attempt to demonize immigrants and people of color, even calling for the death penalty for people who sell drugs. U.S. voters may soon decide on drug decriminalization for the first time. In September 2019, activists in Oregon filed petition 2020-044, which will likely come to a vote in November 2020. If passed, it will decriminalize simple possession and refer offenders to a range of voluntary services such as evidence-based treatment, harm reduction programs, and housing services. The savings on law enforcement, as well as the revenue from cannabis taxes, would fund these programs. Some Democratic presidential candidates, such as Bernie Sanders, include far-reaching drug policy reforms in their platforms. "We are going to end the international embarrassment of having more people in jail than any other country on earth. Instead of spending $80 billion a year on jails and incarceration, we are going to invest in jobs and education for our young people," Sanders promises on his campaign website. Yet, as of press time, no 2020 presidential candidate has made a full-throat endorsement of ending arrests for drug possession and implementing Portugal-style decriminalization. So what would the United States look like if we stopped treating drug users as criminals? Mass incarceration and mass criminalization, which are major drivers of economic inequality, health disparities, and systemic racism, would decrease significantly. The criminalization that targets lower-income communities would slowly wither, affording those affected an opportunity to support themselves and their families. We would no longer fear years like 2018, when law enforcement arrested about 1.43 million people for possessing small amounts of drugs for personal use. The American Civil Liberties Union and Human Rights Watch could work on releasing the 137,000 people they estimate are behind bars in U.S. prisons and jails on any given day for drug possession, many of them being held pretrial because they can't afford to post bail. Thousands more are currently locked up for failing drug tests as a condition of probation or parole could start working toward their freedom. Black people, who represent 13% of the U.S. population, use drugs at similar rates as other groups, would no longer account for 29% of people arrested for drug law violations and 33% of people incarcerated in state prisons for drug possession. Law enforcement would be able to divert resources to serious public safety concerns, such as the 67% of reported rapes that were uncleared in 2018, and the thousands of rape kits that went unprocessed. If mass drug possession arrests stop in the U.S., the thousands of people currently deported every year for possessing any amount of drugs would no longer fear losing their homes. Permanent residents, many of whom have been in the U.S. for decades and have jobs and families, would no longer live with anxiety caused by the automatic detention and deportation, often without the possibility of return, for being caught with any amount of any drug. One may hypothesize that fewer drug possession arrests would mean more crime on the streets, but the Pew Charitable Trust reported in 2017 that there is, quote, "no relationship between drug imprisonment and drug problems," end quote, because under decriminalization, people would still be arrested for committing crimes under the influence of drugs. Decriminalization would only mean the police could no longer waste taxpayer dollars arresting people for possession. Decriminalization also makes it easier to ramp up health and harm reduction services that are known to drastically reduce addiction, overdose deaths, and new hepatitis C and HIV infections. Evidence-based drug treatment could more easily be offered to anyone who wants it. For those who continue to use drugs, services to reduce potential harm, such as screening unregulated drugs for adulterants, community-based naloxone distribution, syringe access programs, supervised consumption sites, and other long-proven approaches, could also be made more widely available. All the pieces are in place for drug decriminalization to take effect in the U.S. Now we just have to demand that our leaders act. To truly end the war on drugs and avoid new public health crises, we need to accept that criminalizing possession offers no solutions or hope for real cultural transformation. Continuing from the winter 2020 issue of Playboy, between the lines, how does it feel to bring a racist to life? Seven actors shared the challenges and responsibilities embodying hatred. The Klan member, the bigoted politician, the slur-spouting athlete, a staple of cinematic evil, roles steeped in racism have never been a simple undertaking for the performers tasked with playing them. While audiences have always loved a good villain, the on-screen depiction of racism carries perhaps more weight today than in previous eras. After all, this is a time where President Donald Trump's vitriol is an accepted presence on Twitter feeds. When NPR publicly defends its labeling of that same president's rhetoric as racist, when we're just 2 years removed from the deadly white supremacist rally in Charlottesville, Virginia, and when mass shootings perpetrated on any given day instill persistent fear and anguish, does art inform how we identify prejudice in our own lives, and do the stories we tell on screen exacerbate or salivate the pain? Playboy spoke with seven actors about their racist roles to examine how we represent hatred in art, the risks and nuances of understanding such mindsets, and the power in reflecting the current state of America. David Dennis Jr. Topher Grace, real-life KKK leader David Duke, and Spike Lee's 2019 Oscar winner, Black Klansman. On confronting Duke's charm, Duke rebranded racism. He's very charming and disarming, so he made racism more palatable. That's true evil. The night before I went in to read for Spike, I was rehearsing alone and I still couldn't say half the words. I told Spike, I'm really uncomfortable speaking like this. If you do that with the wrong director, you don't pay it off the right way, it's very dangerous to make someone look charismatic. But Duke's charisma is what makes him so powerful. William Sadler. Detective Michael Sheehan in Ava DuVernay's 2019 Emmy-winning Netflix miniseries, When They See Us. On Sheehan intimidating the Central Park Five into confessing. During a scene with my co-star, Asante Black, Ava DuVernay took me aside and said, I want you to scare him. So I unleashed this character, and when I finished, I asked Asante, are you okay? And gave him a hug. I'm not comfortable playing those people, but the better I do it, the more impact the story has. It's more important than ever before that we tell stories like these. Garrett Hedlund, Mike Burden in the 2020 film Burden, the real-life story of a Klansman who inherits a KKK memorabilia shop before finding redemption. On filming in the KKK shop, as the crew was setting up, a father and son were walking around. A crew member asked if they worked on set, and the father said, hell no, we're shopping. About time a goddamn place like this opened up. That allowed us to see how real this is. It made our commitment to the project stronger. Alan Tudyk, baseball manager Ben Chapman, 42, the 2013 Jackie Robinson biopic. On using the N-word, while rehearsing those words, I would get tears in my eyes, which wasn't good for the scene. So I would watch these violent street fight videos, and I get a knot in my stomach, and I just get angry. And then I wouldn't cry anymore when I said the word. It was like I got dipped in hate. William Fichtner, District Attorney Flack, Jake Flanagan, in 2006's Best Picture winner, Crash. On whether Flanagan's racial button-pushing makes him racist. Under his breath, my character says, fucking black people. The point of the scene is about choices we make in life and how we can end up in uncool circumstances. I didn't look at him as just racially motivated, but I saw that piece of him when he pulled that card out. Burgess Jenkins, Ray Buds, one of the villains in 2000's fact-based Remember the Titans. On his approach to the persistently racist football star, the guy is angry and frustrated and feels betrayed. And everybody has felt angry, frustrated, and betrayed. The key is to figure out the emotional value and connect to it rather than judge them and say, okay, this guy's a racist jerk. Well, they don't see themselves as racist jerks. Catherine Kellner. Fanny Taylor and John Singleton's 1997 movie Rosewood, based on a true story of a white woman who falsely accuses a black man of rape in the 1920s. On the film's most intense scenes, I go into my trailer and breathe into a paper bag because I was so nervous. But the cast, John Singleton, kept saying, do it because people need to know. In scenes where I cry over and over, part of me honestly wept because of my own ignorance, because the subject matter was so real. But it became one of the best experiences of my life. And to conclude, the data sheet for February Playmate, Chastity Simone. Birthplace, Oak Cliff, Texas. Current city, Los Angeles, California. On the written word. Right now, I'm reading about emotional intelligence, and it's helping me learn the ways people adjust to the world and why. People need to understand that most of our emotions come from childhood, and toxic emotions and trauma change the way people behave. Oh, and my favorite author is Malcolm Gladwell. On faith. My mom and dad were both Baptists, and I was raised going to church every Sunday and Wednesday like a real Southern girl. As an adult, faith is everything to me. I know that faith without work is dead, so prayer is part of my daily routine. On nudity, I love it. I help my mom and sisters get comfortable with themselves because I always walk around naked. I don't care. I really don't. When I get out of the shower, I like to air dry. I'll probably even forget that I'm naked, and the people have a problem with that. On voyeurism. My guilty pleasure is watching YouTube videos of people eating. Not cooking shows, not ASMR, just eating. I can watch it all day. On style. How would I describe my personal style? Sexy. I like my boobs. Feeling sexy makes me feel strong, untouchable, and powerful, like a queen. On bedroom equality. If I have sex and he doesn't bother to make me come, that's a deal breaker. I won't have sex with that person again, even if I loved him. That's quality right there. Also, men, don't think we use toys and vibrators, but don't be afraid to get out of a machine and do what you have to do. It's great for couples to experiment with toys together. On music. I'm obsessed with a pop artist from London named Bree Runway. She writes her own music and she's iconic to me. I'm still waiting for Rihanna to drop her next album. Like, bitch, it's taking you so long. I'm also listening to Summer Walker, Ari Lennox, Beyonce, Megan Thee Stallion, and Saweetie. Saweetie is fire. That's my bitch. On role models. As a kid, I always looked up to my dad. He was the ultimate. He took care of my mom and all 11 children. He had certain quotes he'd say to each of us, and the one he picked for me was, do the right thing. It's my daily reminder. That's about all we've got time for in this week's edition of Centerfold. I'm your volunteer broadcaster, Robert O'Brien. I hope you'll stay tuned for some more great programming here at Sun Sounds of Arizona. Thanks for listening.